Good, well, I'll stand up so I can be heard at the moment. So we've just got one microphone we'll pass round between people. We've assembled at great expense a stellar panel of a cosmologist and a particle physicist. And the idea is this should be maximum audience participation. So I'm just going to start with one question, then it's over to you. And for maximum participation, if people standing up, don't preach sermons, please. If you just have a question, you know, just a few sentences for a question, and our panelists will probably be no more than 2 minutes in giving their reply. So we want to try and get as many questions and answers crammed in, and also have discussion about between the panelists. I'm sure there'll be some disagreements, and that'll be good to air those. So my first question is, what is the relation between the universe and God? So who would like to
You want to start, or
you got to just go this way?
Which, you want to go around?
You want to go just this way?
We could do, yes.
Hi, okay, so my name... Is this audible?
Yes.
Yeah, my name is Robert Mann. Some of you encountered me last night as the program director. My own short answer to this question is that I think the universe, the cosmos, is distinct from God, not so distant that God is fully decoupled, but not part of God. And of course, theologians make their money struggling to understand this relationship. The universe seems to be endowed with a certain level of creative freedom. I take that to be most highly manifest in terms of sentient beings like ourselves, but it seems to be true elsewhere in biology. Anyone that's had a dog or a cat might affirm that statement. Yeah, and I'm inclined to think that extends to the rest of the cosmos, that there is... yes, some constraint from the laws of physics, but they're supple, as Polkinghorne likes to say. They're not so rigid that everything is fully deterministic. They're clearly not so flexible as to allow any chaotic phenomenon to happen. We seem to live in this middle ground, enough structure for reliability, but enough flexibility to make things interesting. My own view is this is a signal of God's love, of the freedom of the Creator in a certain way, to endow creation with that freedom. More can be said, but I'll go this way.
Okay, I'm Don Page from the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Alberta. So my tentative working hypotheses are as follows. I believe that neither the universe nor God is logically necessary, as I believe the truth of mathematical theorems is, or necessary in any clear sense other than meaning what is actual. However, I believe that God does exist and does not depend upon any other being and is the single uncaused cause and creator from nothing of everything outside of himself that is not logically necessary. I take this concept of creatio ex nihilo to imply that there are no other uncaused causes, so that everything outside of God is totally determined by God, leaving no room for libertarian free will by creatures such as humans. Even if it were postulated that God would love for us to have libertarian free will, if uncaused causes did not exist apart from God, God could not create them, since it is impossible to cause something to exist that is uncaused. I believe in glee that God loves elegant existence, creating the universe according to simple and orderly mathematical laws. I believe that God also pours love into the universe by creating sentient beings such as ourselves who can enjoy fellowship with God and enjoy the universe God created. I believe that God created a universe so that the total value of the entire world, the good that God experiences and the good that is experienced by us sentient beings within the universe, is maximized. However, this does not maximize just the value intrinsic to our universe, so we do see this value or evil within it. I do believe this evil is ultimately the responsibility of God, but since it is the cost of maximizing the total value of the world, it is the justified best choice for God as an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, uncaused cause.
I go along more with Robert's point of view here. I believe God has created the universe and it has a degree of independent existence. It has things in it which have properties and propensities, laws of nature. This happens. We ourselves have more than that. We are spiritual beings, and our spiritual nature gives us our sort of free will, if that's the phrase you wish to use. God is rather like a pilot of an aeroplane in some respects. The aeroplane flies along on autopilot most of the time, but occasionally the pilot needs to do something, and so God sometimes needs to do something special, but this is all part of the plan. It's not a disturbance. It was always intended to be like that.
Okay, this is a big question. I'll comment on some other aspects of this. So God is the creator of our universe. The universe is God's handiwork, and so it displays something of his character, and in Psalm 19 we read that it displays his glory. And I'm sure our plenary speaker, Bart Netterfield, later this weekend will talk more about that, and Jennifer Wiseman has also spoken on this before. I believe that we can't derive everything we need to know about God from looking at the universe. I think the Bible is our first and primary source for learning who God is and how we relate to him. But the universe displays a lot of things about God in ways that come home to our senses. So the very vastness of this universe that we've been talking about, its great extent and age, it gives us an idea of the scope of God and his creative ability. The universe is also appears to be fine-tuned for life to exist. And that's something Hugh Ross over here has, of course, done a lot of work on. And that fine-tuning and crafting of the universe tells us something of God's intention, of how he's designed a system from the beginning to allow life like us to not only exist, but to thrive.
I'm not sure whether it's better to go first or last on a question like this. My name is David Wilkinson. I teach theology at Durham University in the United Kingdom. And maybe I can just go in a slightly different direction and say, for me as a theologian, there are a number of parts of the Christian tradition which, when asking the question, what's the relationship between God and the universe, seem to me always important wherever you dip your toe into Christian history. One is that in order to explore that question, Jesus has to be at the center of it, so that our knowledge of God in relation to creation has to be fully embedded in our experience of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. The second is that God is the sole creator of the universe. He has no competitors or peers in that. He is alone as creator. And that's where some of Don's work about creation out of nothing, I think, finds resonances. Third, God loves extravagance. You get that within Job, you get that within Genesis. This delight as God, not just as the divine mathematician or philosopher, but God as the divine artist who loves 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars. And then God loves stuff, the material, dirt, soil. There is a physicality to the Judeo-Christian tradition, which is extremely important in affirming the creation. And then the final thing, I think, for me, which is really important, is that creation is good, but it's not the end of the story. This picture in the New Testament of new heaven and new earth, of the transformation of this universe, has to be part of our understanding of God's relationship between himself and the universe.
Well, thank you very much. Five really good answers, so thank you very much, panel. More questions now, please. Okay, lots of questions. Okay, let's. I'll start over. I've ignored that side. Let's start with you. Yes, okay. Right. I'll come back to this side. Yep, yes.
Would the panel agree that when we apply the word creator to a being beyond the universe, for instance, and the word design and fine tuning, we are using meanings that must come from our own experience of doing something like creating and designing, and that therefore we're sort of analogically applying something about our own experience to something beyond the universe, and that therefore to answer the question before the panel, it's quite important to reflect about what it means to say that a human being has a spiritual nature.
Yes, so the question is, when we answer these questions, we're talking about our own experience, and so part of the question we need to answer is, what does it mean to say that human beings have a spiritual nature? So perhaps we'll go the reverse direction. Not every panel member has to answer, you know, you can pick and choose.
Yes, yeah, so all of our theology has that anthropomorphic tinge to it, in the sense of we take models from our experience. But where it's limited is in the biblical material, which gives us pictures, which often challenge our own understandings and take us further. So particularly some of the images in the book of Job, for example, which actually push some of those questions of creation. And the trouble is, where we reduce models of God to just one model or one picture, the Bible is full of these different pictures, different images, which often clash with each other in order to say, as J.B. Phillips once said, your view of God is too small. It always keeps pushing us out.
I forgot to introduce myself the first time. I'm Deb Harsma. I am president of BioLogos, and before that, I was a professor of astronomy at Calvin College.
Louder.
Oh, got to hold it really close. Okay. I'll just make one brief anecdote that our example that might help us. We're considering what is our creative nature and what is God's. So we think of God as a God of order and creating an orderly universe. And certainly, as I study that in physics, we see lots of equations very neatly laid out. But there's also this random elements. And so people, especially lay people, will often be very concerned about this random element in creation. Why would God create like that? So you get these questions. Is it just our perception that we think creation ought to be orderly? Is random somehow inherently purposeless and unintentional? But then you can think of other aspects of our human creativity, perhaps as we're bearing the image of God, where we use randomness intentionally. And there's, in science, Monte Carlo simulations where you're using randomness to affect, or in simply designing a video game, you put in random elements to make it more creative. So that sometimes those insights go the other direction as you think of different kinds of human creativity.
Yeah, we're told not to make images of God, but the Bible all the time uses language that human beings can understand, and so the teaching that we are in any respect in the image of God is essential for us to know very much about God using the language that can be given to us. So we take all that, but we always know that we'll never have the whole story. It'll just be various viewpoints, and we have to sort of act it out and pray it out.
Yes, I mean, I certainly believe that we create as being in the image of God, but just like my image in the mirror is not a complete representation of me, I think my own creativity lacks that of God. I don't think I can create anything from nothing, whereas God can. And also, of course, what I create is partially determined by other things, and therefore it's not totally determined by me, whereas I believe that because God does create from nothing, everything is totally determined by him. So I think there's the analogy, but then there's also the difference, because what we create certainly has other determining factors, but for God, I think he creates from nothing. So I think he does the total determination.
What they said, that we can go on to another. Really, I don't have any dead.
We can start in the middle next time.
Another question, why not?
Okay.
A great deal of it used with fine-tuning, it was referred to earlier, but I wonder if we could elaborate a little bit on that. Where are science now in regard to fine-tuning? It's used a lot in apologetics, but it's been knocked around by John Carroll, Lawrence Krauss, others. How strong is the evidence of fine-tuning to undergird our belief in the existence of God?
You said we'd start in the middle. Maybe Peter. I'm happy to start, but
we could just go.
All right. So well, that's a very good question, and it's a point of debate. And my own view, honestly, is people are sociologically influenced. Christians really want this to be a thumbprint of God, and theists really want it, non-theists really want it not to be. And that doesn't mean we can't learn things from it, but I think it's an honest statement that we're each influenced somewhat. So that being said, it certainly seems to be a curious fact that things like the relative mass of the proton to the neutron can't be anything it wants to be for life to exist. No one would have a priori guessed this. If you adjust it a little bit, then either the neutron decays too quickly and we can't get stable nuclei, or else all protons become neutrons if it goes the other way, and life as we know it can't exist. Now you might say, oh well, what's the big deal? That's one coincidence. The point is there are lots of these. So many that John Leslie has pointed out, we just can't ignore this as a scientific fact. And this is something that was, I would say, discovered over the last five decades, slowly, piece by piece. You can look at lots of things, the expansion rate of the universe, the charge of the electron relative to other things, so on and so forth. And we don't have any deeper mathematical explanation of this. So what do we do with it? Is this a thumbprint of a creator or not? If we find, by some mechanism, a mathematical explanation, does that look bad for God or does that look good for God? I think these are the theological questions we wrestle with. My own view is this is telling us something quite deep about reality. I'm skeptical of the Lawrence Krauss's and Sean Carroll's of the world that want to have the triumphal atheistic march through the scientific and cultural territory. That being said, I think we need to be tentative. Probably the biggest argument against it is we have other unstable elementary particles like the charm quark and the Higgs boson discovered, whose masses seem arbitrary, and at this point in time, we don't know what they have to do with life. That's sort of the strongest argument empirically against it. And I'll stop there and let somebody else take over.
Okay, I mean, I guess, of course, partly I'm in the Christian community and in the scientific community, so I'm very sympathetic to a lot of the scientific arguments for these things. So I am very sympathetic to the idea that the multiverse explanation for these things, along with the anthropic principle, is perhaps better than saying that God individually fine-tuned the thing. It also fits, I guess, with my own personal theology of believing that God created things most elegantly. And for me, having a multiverse that has some rather elegant physical laws, but that does have the consequence of this extravagance we talk about. I mean, I certainly believe that was a consequence. I mean, it's not absolutely the most elegant, which would be, or the most simplest, which would be a blank. But I guess for me, I find it attractive, both theologically and scientifically, the idea that God had some very elegant forms of the laws, but he didn't have to put any constants in it. Like superstring theory has absolutely no free parameters that you could say are constants of physics. And yet it's supposed to, you know, come out from this a landscape of different possible values, and then we would be in a part which allows our existence. Now, it may be indeed non-trivial to have the overall structure even have any part that allows our existence. So that may be non-trivial, but I think defining the particular fact that we're in this finding is, I don't think God micromanages in the sense of that he chose the particular constants. I guess in a similar sense that I don't think he micromanaged the details of the evolution. I mean, he created the whole process, and in a sense he did the whole thing, but I think he's more interested in the overall thing. So I'm a little bit worried that if Christians jump on the bandwagon of saying the fine-tuning is evidence for God, this is a little bit like jumping on the anti-evolution bandwagon of saying, well, God separately designed the species. I do believe that God's designed the species, including ours, but through an overall pattern of biological evolution. And in a similar way, I think although it's too early to be sure, that perhaps in a similar way, God designed the whole thing, the whole multiverse with all of the different values, but he didn't specifically design the particular values that we see in our part of it.
Yeah, if you have just one universe and we have no evidence for more, then I think these fine-tuning constants are very interesting. I wouldn't worry about the masses of odd elementary particles right now. That's work in process. But I'd add this. You say, what one says, one feels, that we are special. And so the fact that the universe is special and matches us is remarkable. But if you are really a kind of physicalist, materialist, I don't think you have any great right to say that we are special. What is special about us? We're just a particular way that the cosmic tea leaves have fallen. So you probably don't need to worry about this. You just say, okay, that's the way it is. A whole lot of random numbers, another lot would have been just as good. There's nothing special about us. But of course, we don't believe that. We do believe there's something special about us. And I think that even materialists in their hearts believe there's something special about us too.
I don't have very much more to add, just that I think the fine-tuning that we see is supportive and consonant with faith in God, but not proof of it.
Yes, I would just build on that and say that 30 or so years ago, John Polkinghorne said that fine-tuning was a pointer rather than a proof. And I think that's a very helpful distinction. And it's also something, I think, which is better with a sense of awe. So you go, gosh, wow, rather than let me use this to prove to you some kind of creator. And I think if you look at the origins of the design argument, it began with, gosh, wow, isn't this amazing, rather than someone walking across a field finds a watch, therefore there must be a divine watchmaker. So I think fine-tuning might get us a little more back to the gosh and the wow. And then you open up the conversation. You open up the question.
Can I make a rejoinder to some of these?
Well, on the way of passing the microphone to you, let me just add the most recent issue of PSCF, which you should all be subscribed to, has a nice sermon by Owen Gingrich on fine-tuning, especially of the carbon resonance.
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to say about fine-tuning, think of what the situation would be if it were the other way around. I remember as a child being told the origin of the universe was just a random thing, mindless, spewing out, and here we are. But that's not what we found. What would we conclude if we found that life had no dependence whatsoever on the constants of nature that was interesting? Now, I'm betting that non-theists would say, see, you are wrong. God had nothing to do with creation. This is why I think it's telling us something and why I respectfully don't quite share Don's viewpoint here. I think we need to be open-minded as to what happened, but I also don't think we should retreat and just say, well, but that to me, that's the start, not the end point. I do think you should all think about what you would conclude about reality if the constants of nature were shown to have absolutely nothing to do with life, in the sense that we could slide them all over the place relative to each other. They could be anything we want, and life as we know it would still exist. We have discovered this is indeed not the case about our universe. There is a sharp window, and John Leslie has pointed out this sharp window should be telling us something. That's why I have this viewpoint, and if, you know, maybe I'll have to go off the bandwagon. My name is Rob. I once believed in the fine tuner, but, you know, there you go.
Okay, I mean, you're the back, right at the back.
John, what's the current status of Boltzmann braids?
Well, Boltzmann braids are, this is the,
don't know.
Oh, sorry, I need the, oh yeah, I need this.
Otherwise, we can't hear you, John.
Yeah, yeah.
You can.
You can. Okay, what's the, yeah. Okay. Let's see. This is Barth, right?
Barth.
Yeah. Okay. My vision is barely good enough. Okay. So Barth Netherfield asks about Boltzmann brains. These are hypothetical entities in which you get thermal or vacuum fluctuations in otherwise sort of empty space, or thermal that in which a brain appears for a very short time, maybe has a conscious perception, and then disappears. They're a problem there are problems in some versions of cosmology where if the universe lasts infinitely long, and if ordinary observers like us only last a finite time, then there would seem to be, even though these Boltzmann brains are excessively rare in space, if it lasts forever, there would, naively, it looks like there would be infinitely many more Boltzmann brains. And then then you might say, well, then we should expect ourselves to be Boltzmann brains, but almost certainly Boltzmann brains would mostly have disordered observations. I mean, if you just popped into being out of nothing and there was, and then popped back, why would you see a whole lot of people around you? So it seems statistically inconsistent with our observations. So I think it's a reductio ad absurdum of very simple-minded things in a similar way to the ultraviolet catastrophe was a reductio ad absurdum of classical physics back in the late 19th century. So I think we have to have some ways, and there's a whole lot of different proposals how to deal with that, the so-called measure problem in cosmology of proposing measures to so that Boltzmann brains don't dominate. And there are ways to do that. I think the thing is, I myself propose some various ways. I have a later paper on the SAD measure and various things, but they're all rather sort of ad hoc. None of them really seem very elegant yet. And so I'm not very happy about any of the proposals. It's a problem waiting to be solved, but I don't think it's a serious, it's analogous to the ultraviolet catastrophe. It showed something was wrong with physics as we then knew it, and this shows us something's wrong with at least some naive extrapolations that we now have, but it doesn't really say that there necessarily has to be a problem with all formulae. There's a lot we don't know that we need to work out, and what we need to work out should be, we wanted to predict it, that ordered observations are not extremely rare, that what we see is not extremely rare in the universe.
Anyone else like to comment?
Go ahead. Are you going to say something? Yeah. No. Well, so, I mean, the good thing about Boltzmann's brains, it keeps theoretical physicists employed. in the sense there's a measure, but I guess what troubles me about him is it looks to me more like this is a sign that looking in this direction of extrapolating out to infinite resources is a bad idea. And philosophically, none of us have any way of knowing. We are not a quantum brain that temporarily fluctuated out of nothing, imagining we're at this meeting right now and will disappear in the next nanosecond. We can't know for sure, Don. It's not possible.
Yeah, yeah, now, it's just a theory.
But I share your view. You know, come on. I mean, you believe this stuff? Well, it, you know, puts food on my table. But so I do think it. I agree with Don. I think it's right that this is telling us something that's bad news about extrapolation. But I view this as something that it. There are no elegant ways out of this at this stage. It's not clear there ever will be. So my question for the people that work in this area is, at what point are you convinced this is the wrong way to go about looking at the problem at all? I mean, maybe it's a problem that has no solution unless you completely change gears and avoid a multiverse. Surely this is a possibility.
Well, I mean, it doesn't depend on a multiverse. It just depends. I mean, now we seem to have a positive cosmological constant, which seems to suggest if there weren't a multiverse, if there is a multiverse, it's believed that the universe is at a very, very long time unstable, and they'll be tunneling to new universes. But if there isn't, if this one is really absolutely stable with a cosmological constant, it would go on forever, and we would have the Boltzmann brain problem in this single universe. So I think it's a problem. I think it's an issue we have to solve whether or not we have a multiverse. It's just if the universe goes on long enough, and of course the problem hasn't been with us that long. So it's not, you know, I can't say the fact we haven't solved it doesn't mean there isn't a solution. But I will admit that this measure problem, which I would interpret as, how do you translate from a quantum state to the probabilities of observations? How can you get probabilities of observations or measures of from the quantum state? That's something that's not specified in the dynamical laws of physics. It's also not specified in initial conditions. It, I think, is a third element we need. I think we need... People in physics used to say we had a so-called theory of everything, by which they mean the dynamical laws of how to go from the past to the future. That's not enough, as Harlan Hawking emphasized. You also need to know the boundary conditions. How did the universe start? Or you need to know the quantum state. But it seems that you also need to know the rules for getting from the quantum state to the probabilities of observations. And we don't have that yet. And that is maybe going to be very difficult. I must admit I'm a bit... At 65, I'm a bit pessimistic that we'll get anywhere near the solution of that within my lifetime, and it might be a sufficiently hard problem that we don't get anywhere in 100 years. I mean, we're at the right place in the right time if we could solve this problem to make a great discovery. I think it would be even greater than the invention of quantum mechanics in the earlier part of the 20th century. But it may be a similar or even greater difficulty So even though I know I'm at the right place in the right time to make a huge discovery in physics, I think my chance of doing it is virtually nil.
Just to add one or two things, of course there are other unsatisfactory features about physics which we kind of put out of the way and live with. Their renormalization gets rid of infinities. There's a technique of doing that, but it's not very satisfactory, however it works. And there's a question of why the cosmological constant is small rather than hugely large. Another big problem. We just try and ignore it, but it's still there. So a lot of work to do.
That one's a fine-tuning problem, the cosmological constant. Well, it's a very big fine-tuning problem.
Why isn't it huge?
Yeah, yeah. That's a very big... I mean, it's 120 orders of magnitude smaller than the natural value. So it's a very fine-tuned problem.
Yeah. I mean, there's something seriously wrong there.
Or it's a theistic selection effect. I know that's politically incorrect to say, but it's a logical...
Well, as I said in my talk this morning, it's testable in principle. If you can find whatever it is that gets maximized and see if the value is at the maximum.
I'm skeptical of that too. But
we're going to have another question. Thank you. It's good to see this discussion. Let's go right to the back here. Gentleman in black. Yes, right.
Yeah, the question I wanted to ask is, given that the Bible indicates that God began his work of redemption before he created the universe, how does that affect your view of the universe?
Interesting. Thank you, God.
I'll just pass this along.
Just pass the parcel. Go ahead.
I think if I may take the question, just to pick up Don's point earlier this morning, and you very honestly noted in terms of the language of best possible worlds, how that then relates both to resurrection and to new heaven and new earth. And there is a sense in which Christian understanding of redemption is not just about restoring a fallen world back to the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. It's actually about God's plan to take us from the Garden of Eden to the heavenly city. Now, the fact that we've fallen and sinned means that both of these purposes of God are together in the work of redemption through Christ. And so it would be wrong of us to say that this is the best possible world in the sense that redemption simply restores back to a world that's not fallen. God's purposes are much greater than that into new creation. But I share Don's point about we need to do a little more thinking about this. Mm. It's not an easy answer.
Yeah, that's a huge question. I'll just point out that the New Testament describes Christ as the cosmic creator from the beginning. So certainly Christ is not just about saving us from our sins. It is about redeeming all of creation and in fact being the source of all creation. Without him, nothing is made that has been made.
Yeah, I think this is saying that redemption was not just a sort of a sudden rescue procedure, but something that was in the plan all the time. And we use words, temporal words, to do with God, but we shouldn't. We just haven't got the language.
No, it's an excellent question, Hugh. To be honest, I haven't thought of it that much in these terms, but I would certainly agree with you. I think that God planned the redemption from the beginning, even before the fall, before sin, and so on. So, yeah, I would think that would be part of his purposes, in my view, to make the world the best possible, that one should include that redemption, and that's part of the process, you know, because I come at more from a physics background of seeing the elegance. That's the part I can have a little bit of grasp on, and I would greatly appreciate help from theologians. Well, with your comment of seeing how to fit it in theologically with that, but I think it's an excellent point that God, I think he creates the whole universe to make so that, well, all of creation, the present age and the age to come, so that plus God plus everything else is the best possible.
I think the interesting question raised by this observationally is, are the laws of physics in need of redemption? Or is that the best they're ever going to get? And I've often wondered about this myself. I mean, if we believe we live in a fallen world, aren't the laws of physics themselves somehow fallen? Or not? But that's how people like David make money. At least that's how I think they should make money. Because if they do, then my grad students will go, well, never mind. They'll get jobs. Really, yeah, I think it's an interesting question.
I suspect that they are, I mean, just because it seems to be, to me, my a lot of things, cancer and disease and so on, do seem to be a consequence of the laws we have. So I do think that there are going to be laws that are certainly going to be better for us. Now, you know, there is, of course, the remaining things. If the new age does have things better, why did God create the present age? So, you know, that's a part that's still a bit mysterious. But I think that the laws of physics, well, I do think that they're going to be redeemed so that we can have joy and pleasure and we can be free from sin and disease and so on.
You're absolutely right. That's how we should be making our money. The trouble is, in theology, there's not a great deal of money to be made in anything.
He has $13.5 billion from the Hague. Surely he could employ us.
But I think where I start on this, where I get a glimpse on it, is to ask the question, if the resurrection of Jesus is the first fruits of that which is to come, do we get a glimpse from the resurrection of Jesus' relationship with the laws of physics, which might give us one or two suggestions. And so we know, and lots of people have talked about it over the year, that in the resurrection, you have this sense of continuity and discontinuity in the person of Jesus, and his ability to appear in rooms with locked doors, to appear at different times, to be more than the physicality of the Jesus who was crucified. And therefore, I think, maybe we can think together about what our experience of time and space might be in new creation. Might it be real but not as limiting as it is in this creation, for example? It's those kind of questions that I think a dialogue between theologians and scientists would be really helpful at doing.
Okay, well, thank you. I think that there are lots more questions. I think our time is up, and I think this time has gone very fast, and I think it's a wonderful way in which to end. So does Jesus' resurrection show that there are different physical laws which will apply after the deaths of all of us? And I think it's pretty clear from the resurrection that they do. And I think that's a greater note on which to end. So can we thank our panelists all very much?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.